Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, this is Andrew Doyle, writer, comedian, and columnist for Spiked. And you are listening to Culture Wars, you lucky things. This is a podcast where we get to the bottom of what's going on in our culture by going beyond the headlines and beyond all the partisan bickering. My latest guests were Katie Herzog and Jesse Single. You might be familiar with their podcast Blocked and Reported, which is extremely popular. They're both fantastic journalists as well. And they tend to talk about what they describe as internet bullshit. So we touched on a little bit of that in our conversation. And we talked about various things. We talked about their experiences with cancel culture, the rise of critical race theory, and what the US election means for the culture wars. Enjoy! So I thought I'd just start by asking you to talk us through how you met and how you started your podcast, which has been hugely successful, and what the podcast is about, just in case there are people listening who don't know quite what it is you do. And if you could just run through that for us and a bit about your background.
So I sent Jesse some effusive fan mail requesting dick pics. That's how we met. No, what really happened is that I was working on a piece on for The Stranger. I was a freelancer for Seattle's Alt Weekly, an Alt Weekly that barely exists at this point post-COVID. But at the time, it was a robust publication called The Stranger. And I was working on a piece on detransitioners, who most of your audience probably knows what that is. But just to explain, these are people who have transitioned from one sex or gender to the other and then transitioned back. And I had read a bunch of Jesse's work on trans issues, and I was really impressed by it. His work was different than most of the work that I'd read on trans stuff. And so I reached out to him. I wanted to interview him for my piece. He declined. He was threatened by me. I think that was the issue. But we struck
Wait,
up a sort what, of...
did I really decline? You I feel said like you you're were, telling the story incorrectly.
I feel you like I'm dredging up some terrible past here.
Fuck you!
That's not what this is meant to be. Let's all get along.
You said there can only be one TERF in American media.
Yeah, exactly.
So I emailed Jesse and we ended up sort of just striking up a dialogue that way. And then we became, you know, Twitter friends. And we met in New York when I was there visiting for a conference at one point. And despite his appearance, we maintained a friendship even after meeting in person.
It's very kind.
So from your perspective, Jesse, can you talk about what drew you to Katie as and this working partnership?
Yeah, I mean, I just always really liked her work. And there's a, you know, I want to use the term fearlessness, which on the one hand is silly because to me, like, actual fearless journalists are in Syria or whatever. But on the other hand, it does take guts to write about certain issues in a forthright way. And I always appreciated the way Katie just didn't really care about all the noise online. And I thought she... You know, there are a number of controversies, both involving gender and other issues, where I thought she really did that old, out-of-fashion journalistic thing of just trying to get to the truth, the peanut gallery be damned. And I think that's what I respected the most about her. Her piece on detransitioners, which was a little different from one I ended up writing along various lines, I also just thought was excellent. And when I saw the ridiculous amount of flack she caught for this article that was in no way transphobic, which is sort of a whole other story, I think, you know, I felt sympathetic to her and I appreciated the work she put into it.
This is something I'd come across. There was an article in the New York Times about people who have been quote unquote cancelled, and all three of us are featured in that article. And it starts with you, Katie. It starts with your article about detransitioners, but you also, Jesse, have written about this, the subject of trans children. I know you've written an article for The Atlantic about trans children, for instance, and this is a very sensitive area. Why is it you think, I mean, in both cases, you're coming from it from a position of compassion. It isn't a hostile or hateful approach at all to these issues. So why is it you think that it's been interpreted as such? Or why would that merit cancellation?
I don't know. So the legitimate element here, the kernel of reasonable truth, is that gender nonconforming people have often been treated terribly. If you're like a girly little boy or a tomboyish girl, it's often been difficult to be in those roles. So I think a lot of the people who have sort of turned this into a bit of a moral panic come from a good place. It's just, it's gotten to the point where even on genuinely important thorny questions, like when a 13 or 14 year old should go on hormones, you're not allowed to even discuss it really, or to treat it like any other medical or mental health issue, which is what it is. So, you know, I just think it's in a long line of other subjects that sort of become a sacred space where you have to tread very carefully. And I think that's unfortunate because parents and kids and teenagers need to make difficult medical decisions. And there are trade-offs, as there are everywhere else in life. And just seeing the way this has been discussed publicly has been really frustrating. And I think that's one of the reasons we started the podcast, is just to sort of cut through all that and be like, no, we're going to discuss complicated issues as complicated issues.
One of the things I noticed, Katie, in that article about cancel culture, is you mentioned that you even faced some trouble when you were going to say a lesbian bar. So there were people within the LGBT community who had an issue with you then. Is that something that is still going on, or is that something that was just short-lived at the time?
Well, the lesbian bars are all dead, not just because of COVID, but because I don't know about how it is in the UK, but lesbian bars have sort of gone by the wayside. Now we have queer bars, which are different. But no, the amount of sort of in-person vitriol I experienced after this piece came out was really sort of shocking. So there was what you would expect from the online, you know, the discourse. It was a dumpster fire. People were accusing me of transphobia and bigotry and being a literal Nazi and all of that stuff online, as you would expect. But it also went offline. So there are stickers still. This piece was published 3 years ago, and there are stickers all over Seattle calling me transphobic, calling me a Nazi apologist. There's actually one calling me a Jordan Peterson apologist, which is the most embarrassing.
Even worse.
There are people burned stacks of the paper and sent me video. I never saw this, but apparently there was a photo of me in a urinal at a gay bar in Seattle. So this went very much beyond sort of just like, you know, Twitter shit talking. It became this sort of very heated in-person harassment campaign.
And how does that, I mean, look, all three of us, I'm sure, get a lot of abuse online. And I used to say, oh, it doesn't bother me, water off a duck's back. But actually, I have to be honest and think, actually, because it's so consistent, it does have an effect, doesn't it? I mean, how do you two feel about what happens? I think who gets more? Is it more level?
Jesse gets more.
Right.
Jesse gets more online.
Right.
I think I get more. The repercussions in my personal life have been greater because I'm a lesbian and I have lived in, you know, queer circles for the last 15 years of my life. And so I was sort of excommunicated from in real life friendships. And that's really the hardest part about this, is losing people that I care about or cared about over this article that I think oftentimes they hadn't actually read. They had just sort of heard that it was transphobic and they assumed that it was true because other people were saying it. In terms of online stuff, I think Jesse gets way more hate than I do.
Why is that, which is, do you think?
Sexism. It's got to be sexism. Only maybe homophobia too. No, I'm kidding. No, it's because Jesse has a bigger platform.
Right, okay.
I think that's true. He wrote his piece for The Atlantic. Mine was for, you know, a small city's alt weekly. And like legitimately famous people came for Jesse, like Lena Dunham called him an asshole, which is true, but it's not because of the article.
It's a legitimate point. Yeah. But I mean,
it is a legitimate point.
But that's interesting because I find, particularly in the UK, what I've noticed is the people who get branded as TERFs or the people who are deemed to be transphobic, and they almost never are, I should add. I mean, I'm not denying that there are transphobes out there, but the vast majority of people who are so branded just simply don't fit into that category. But more often than not, women tend to get more of the abuse.
I get called a TERF and Jesse gets called a chaser, which is ironic because really he's the TERF and I'm the chaser. So it did sort of break down into these kind of stereotypical, you know, people assume that the straight guy has some like ulterior sexual motive and that the lesbian is a TERF, of course. Yeah, it's been difficult, but at the same time, it's also been incredible for my career. And that's sort of the irony here, is that the more hate people, the more shit that they throw at me, the bigger my profile gets. gets, the more patrons we get for our podcast, the more job opportunities I get. In some ways, there have been like other real like material consequences. You know, I worked in an environment at the Stranger that was, it was difficult. It was, in some ways, it was hostile. And a lot of that came from the article itself, because there was a contingent of people who sort of never forgave me for writing this piece. And I don't think I'd be able to get a job at some place like, you know, I don't think I would get published at like the New York Times will write about me. They probably wouldn't publish me at this point. So there are consequences like that. But on the other hand, in this new media ecosystem that we're all existing in, it's been great for Jesse and I.
But that's why I suppose you open yourself up to the accusation of being grifters, right? That you're deliberately provoking in order to help your career. But how do you respond if people say that?
Well, I mean, at this point, I don't think we're rich enough to be grifters. If we're grifters, we're not that successful at it.
Well, I'm called a grifter and I can't afford anything. So,
I just ask people to tell me what they, I mean, this is, it always comes back to this. If someone calls me anything, I'll block them or I'll say, what is it I've said or written that you disagree with?
You're asking for detail there. That's not fair. It's like,
well, that's what I'm saying. 90% of the time, they just know they hate me or they're supposed to hate me. It's like, it's sort of a game to them. Whereas I, even on our podcast, which is irreverent, I take our views and opinions seriously and that I'd like to think I've thought them through and that we can discuss them carefully. If you have disagreement with us, you should be able to tell me what it is, but generally speaking, people can't, or at least the people who are the most vitriolic can't. So who cares? They're hacks.
But that's an interesting point though, to me, is it the case that they simply don't know what they're talking about? Or is it that they know that you haven't really said any of these things, but they just don't care about the truth? I mean, in terms of, like you say, Kate, I don't think anyone could have read your article who really got angry about it. Whenever you see these big outcries, big outrages, like even going back to the Salman Rushdie affair, the people who were burning his books hadn't read his book. Well, they couldn't because they burned the fucking thing. But I mean, right. Like with you guys, that people are attacking you for something that's in their heads. Is it like a kind of collective hysteria where they have bought their own imaginary versions of you? Or is it that they know there's nothing to it and that they're simply enjoying the pile on? I don't know. I'm just putting it out there.
I think it's the first. I try to assume good faith in people, even if their arguments are stupid and incorrect and they haven't read the work. I try to believe that people mean what they say, mm-hmm. for better or worse. You know, Jesse has the exact correct response when we get into these stupid arguments online, which is to say, like, show me the line, show me the part that you disagree with. And I do the same thing. If somebody calls me transphobic, I say, okay, well, find the transphobic thing that I've said. I've written about this stuff. Like, Google it. It should be pretty easy for you to find the transphobia that is threaded through my work. And nobody can ever do it because it just doesn't exist. That, for some reason, never convinces people to reevaluate their beliefs, which is the really frustrating thing.
But what's kind of interesting is, like, there's been such a collapse of sort of left of center intellectual life, at least in the States, that if you say, okay, point me to what you actually disagree with, then you're a debate bro or you're a nuance monger. And that's supposedly a bad thing to say, defend your opinion. So we're at a point where it's like everything's just a meme or a cartoon. And, you know, everyone knows Katie Herzog's a transphobe. So why would you disagree with that? It's very cultish and groupthink and sort of middle school cafeteria. And I just don't like there's, I'm surprised at the number of high-profile professional journalists who are just unfamiliar with, like, the basic tools of explaining their position or defending it. Because, like, that's sort of why I'm in this field. I appreciate that process, and I think it's increasingly out of vogue.
And I wonder why it is the case that it is, as you say, a lot of journalists who are like this, but also academics. I mean, I saw there was a tweet recently that went viral where an academic was saying, you know, debate is a cis heteronormative white supremacist construct. In other words, having a conversation apparently is something that queer black people aren't capable of doing. I mean, how patronizing and inadvertently racist and homophobic can you get? I mean, but why is it that it's the supposed educated people who are coming out with this drivel? That's something I really would love to get to the bottom of. If you can help me, that'd be great, because I haven't got a clue.
This is maybe a mean interpretation, but there are certain corners of academia and journalism. Maybe I'm curious if, Katie, you agree with me on this, where you don't actually have to be smart to produce publishable work. You can just sort of remix and repeat the same themes in different ways. Like, a lot of the stuff that gets published is just, it's very hard to make any sense of it, and you can gain platform and some degree of renown just by regurgitating stuff. It's very different from sort of the style of writing I grew up with and aspired to. So there's benefits to just jargon and drivel sometimes.
I remember my supervisor at Oxford saying to me once, you know, the reason why all this stuff gets published is because the publishers don't understand what the people are talking about. It's not because there's any real substance to it. And I remember in particular, I saw Judith Butler giving a talk and she'd come in to give a talk. And I thought she was so lucid and interesting and funny even. And I thought, why don't you write like this? You know, why? Because Judith Butler is possibly the worst writer who has ever existed. And yet in person, she's personable and interesting and smart. And there's something that's either... It makes me suspect that she's hiding bad ideas when she uses multiple clauses and terminology that she knows no one will understand.
Maybe she's a performance artist. Maybe like upon her deathbed, we will find out that this was all a big joke.
I hope so. I hope we could say the same about Robin DiAngelo as well. Well, because she feels like performance art, doesn't she?
Yes.
Just this process by which you see professional writers who, you know, academics, there are incentives to write in an obfuscatory way. I mispronounced that word, but you know, the shift from black people are oppressed to black bodies are erased. Just all these little new ways of talking and writing that don't really parse to the average person, but they're signals that you've been educated in the right way and that you've read your Ta-Nehisi Coates. Nothing wrong with Ta-Nehisi Coates. I think a lot of what he's written is great, but it's just the sort of academicization of writing for the public has gotten really bad. And yeah, it's weird because again, like I'd like to think when I write stuff that basically anyone could read and understand, but it's, I just think journalism, maybe like academia, is becoming more and more sort of a rich kids club and not a place for just normal people. I mean, which I guess makes sense because our whole industry is collapsing and you sort of need money to be a part of it now.
Yeah, I think that is one of the underlying factors here is I don't know what the situation of the media is in the UK, but in the US, you know, before the internet, when every town, every small city had a weekly or a daily paper and multiple daily papers, sometimes, you know, a morning paper and an evening paper. Well, that's how reporters got their start, was going and like having a boring beat, like covering the courts or covering the school board or something like that. And those papers don't exist anymore. So all of those farm teams, you know, you would start out at a local paper, then work your way up to a regional paper, and then maybe go to a national paper. That model doesn't exist anymore. Now you're a blogger. You know, there's fewer people who go to journalism school, including me. I haven't taken any journalism courses. And I think that there's sort of the profile of the journalist has maybe changed a little bit. So it's a little bit more now about our own egos, right? Mm-hmm. About becoming your own brand, because that's how you get ahead in this new ecosystem. It's not to work your way up from the bottom and to cover the school board meetings and then work your way up. It's to get 100,000 followers on Twitter. And the way to do that is to be voicey and to be opinionated, and oftentimes to just repeat these platitudes that are popular in the current discourse.
It feels like slogans a lot of the time instead of thought. But yes. it's like you were saying, it's a kind of signal that you're in the club. And the phrases you use, erasure, and I mean, if you take Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, there were two things about that book that I found very off-putting. And one of them was this continual use of the word bodies, about white bodies and black bodies. And I find it actually very dehumanizing. And I really find it rebarbative. I really balk at it. And this might be something, I wondered if it was to do with Judith Butler. She wrote a book called Bodies That Matter back in the 90s, one of the early queer theory texts. Does it come from there? What is being said here? What's happening there? Jesse, do you know?
No, I don't. And that perhaps that's true. I've sort of stopped trying to understand the rules of these linguistic shifts. Like I will generally follow them just to be a good soldier. Like in the States, a bunch of newspapers and magazines decided all at once that they're going to capitalize black, but not white. And, you know, I read the explanations. They didn't, not only did they make sense, but similar to what you're saying, they were a little bit offensive because many of them said that black Americans all share some common heritage, which when you look at the sheer diversity of Africa, like the place anyone who's black, their ancestry is from most recently, it's a far more diverse place than Europe.
Yeah.
So why would it be the case that they share something in common, but white Europeans don't? Like it's the concept of the euphemism treadmill, I think is really useful here. I guess that's like, Steven Pinker and John McWhorter, where it's just anything with sort of a negative valence attached to it changes every few years. And I think you can't always explain the changes. And usually I'll just go along with it. But yeah, I think in general, more and more sort of queer theory is getting injected into this stuff. So it'd be curious for someone to track the bodies thing, actually.
Jesse's always blaming the queers. It's just the homophobia just seeps
I'm
out.
I'm incredibly homophobic.
It's the queers' fault. Well, See, I'm with you to a degree about if something naturally evolves linguistically and in terms of professional practice, then I'm happy to go along with that. The reason I won't start capitalizing black and not white is because it feels like it's been imposed by ideologues.
Yes.
So
yes.
The Associated Press have put this stuff out and they've said, now this is what the new rule is, or say Merriam-Webster Dictionary changing the definition of racism in accordance with critical race theory. I'm not going to go along with it because most people don't feel that that is the definition of racism, and most people aren't going to start capitalizing black and not capitalizing white. You know, it's, I feel like it's almost like a kind of responsibility not to accede to this
yes.
stuff.
Yeah, I refuse to capitalize the word black. I think it's dangerous to put that much emphasis on race in the first place. As a concept, I don't like it. I feel the same way about the term sexual preference, which I was never a fan of until this week. And now I'm told that we're not supposed to use the word sexual preference. And all of a sudden I have one.
I should explain this is a story. You might be able to tell me with this. From what I gather, it started on Twitter. Someone saying that sexual preference is a homophobic term because it implies choice, right?
Right. We're in the midst of the Senate hearings to confirm Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, Amy Cohen Barrett. What's her ACB? What's her actual name, Jesse? Cohen?
Yeah.
Coney? Something like that. So there's this conservative woman is probably going to be appointed to the Supreme Court, and obviously people don't like her. And she used the term sexual preference, and so immediately the term sexual preference was verboten to the point where the dictionary actually the day that this happened, like actually inserted a clause in the definition of sexual preference, saying that it was offensive.
That's insane to me. I've written an article about this because I've noticed recently that whoever is running dictionaries is super woke, super into social justice theory and ideology. And they're not changing definitions in accordance with common usage, which is what the dictionary is for, but rather what they wish the words did mean and the way they want the words to be used. And that's not their job, frankly. Why has that happened? Why? I mean, it feels conspiratorial to say that all these people are...
Yeah, I think there's a lot of social pressure and there's a bit of a moral panic and hysteria going on in the States right now. Like there's, to me, like the general outrage over bad policing, which is a problem that we've had for a long time, is completely legitimate. But the term a lot of lefties use in the States, the professional managerial class, I think is very useful. The sorts of people who graduated from good college, are in management roles, are on their way to management roles, they have a very specific set of linguistic and etiquette priorities. And I think they're the sorts of people who would go work for a dictionary or work for a book publisher. And for them, they're just trying to do what humans do. It's like a will to power thing. They're trying to exert influence on the way people talk. So, you know, I had heard some people say sexual preference is offensive, but just how overnight it became not only offensive, but sort of unspeakable. And to see the dictionary respond that quickly, it's just, that's creepy as hell, man.
Well, and there are all of these cases where people, you know, you could find like the AP using sexual preference like a month ago, or in some cases, the same people who are now saying that the term sexual preference is offensive in their archives from last year were using the term sexual preference.
Well, I have preferences for different types of shoes, you know.
Right.
I mean, why is it offensive? And it doesn't offend any gay people I know.
Andrew, you just compared gay people to shoes.
To shoes.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, how dare you.
I have internalized homophobia or shoe phobia. Maybe it's a hatred of shoes. I don't know.
You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show.
A lot of this depends on mind reading, on saying, oh, well, you said this, but I interpret that as you saying that. So preferences are a good example. I prefer pizza to broccoli.
Yeah.
I did not choose to prefer pizza to broccoli. It's biology, it's culture, it's upbringing. You could totally say someone has a sexual preference without saying that they chose it. And I thought it was pretty clear from the context of the confirmation hearing of this woman who I don't want confirmed. And I don't think they should even be considering in light of this other recent history with Merrick Garland, blah, blah, blah. People can Google it. But just sort of the immediacy of the pile on and how disingenuous it is almost makes me want to defend her. I don't want to be in the position of defending her.
Right. I think that's one thing that Jesse and I often find ourselves doing is defending people who we genuinely disagree with and don't actually like, because the principle is more important than these particular individual cases.
I think that's the test, isn't it? Is if you're willing to stand up for someone you just fundamentally disagree with, but they're right to say what they think, to say what they believe. I mean, that's really interesting. I think what you're saying is right about the rapidity with which the dictionary adopted this. That is straight out of Orwell. It is someone in the Ministry of Information changing the words that we use. I find it genuinely frightening.
Well, the interesting thing about this, sorry to interrupt you, Andrew, but is that, Orwell, it was top down, and what we're seeing now is bottom up, which in some ways is a little bit more terrifying to me, because it looks like a popular cause as opposed to these sort of, draconian government measures. This is coming from ourselves. Nobody is forcing us to do these things.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I wanted to ask you as well about the difference between the UK and the US, right? Because I feel like it's all your fault, really. I think we're getting a lot of your stuff. I think we've always got things from America about 5 years later than you guys do. But I mean, critical race theory, which is so much about the specific legacy of slavery in America and Jim Crow and very specific to your country, is not the same here. We don't have that history of, obviously we were involved in the slave trade, but we didn't have the slaves weren't here, right? The people who were involved were transporting. It's societally incredibly different. So to map on this theory into our institutions, our educational corporate institutions, governmental institutions, it actually is incoherent. So why is it taken on so much over there? And can you take it back, please?
I don't think we can. I think, unfortunately, it is spread beyond our borders to the point where it will reach into every corner of the world, unfortunately. That's a good question.
Do you see anything of value in it? In critical race theory?
I'm not an expert on critical race theory. I can't speak the language. I find it almost impossible to read critical race theory, because it is like reading lots of Butler, where, the meaning seems to be obfuscated. I think it's good that people are thinking about the history, the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow in this country. Obviously, what is happening now is a result of our history, but the current discourse has just become so wildly out of touch with, I think, reality, that it's disturbing.
It goes back to what we were saying earlier about, it's almost like they're inviting us to accept a new reality, right? So the evidence simply isn't there in the UK to suggest that people of colour are oppressed and victimised across the board. That is not to say that racism doesn't exist and we need to stamp it out wherever we see it. But the evidence of this broad systemic problem just simply isn't there. And to even point that out is seen as evidence of the systemic problem, which puts us in a real bind, because we can't have an adult discussion about these very important issues.
In the States, at least, it's immensely complicated. And there are groups that are trapped, and I really do think trapped is the right word, in intergenerational cycles of poverty, who have not been given a fair way out. And that's absolutely true. And I think especially the history of the States since we ended sort of legal segregation, all the shenanigans, there were endless shenanigans to stop Black people from moving to the suburbs, to oppress them in other ways. That stuff's all real. And it can all be described in plain language that anyone could understand. The way that stuff works today is complicated, not least because it isn't just about color. Like, in terms of just economic success, a lot of the groups that are most successful in the U.S. are not white. So whatever's going on is a little bit more complicated than racism. Like, we have, Ghanaians and Nigerians are doing very well in the States. And it's complicated because they're recent immigrant groups. They have the capital to immigrate. That puts them on a different playing field than everyone else. But if you care about this stuff, which I'd like to think I do, you have to talk about it in a bit more of a careful way than the sort of Robin DiAngelo, white supremacy is this unchanging monstrosity. Because you're not going to solve real problems with this sort of cartoonish understanding of what the problems are.
Right. I mean, I think if Robin DiAngelo, if you care deeply about racism and Robin DiAngelo is your solution to the problem of racism in the United States, it's not going to solve the problem.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's really the issue here, is like a lot of these prescriptions that come from critical race theory, the evidence that we have shows that they either aren't beneficial or they are ultimately detrimental. They actually make things worse rather than better.
I think the problem is like a lot of the solutions are not sexy. Like, I don't know how it works in the UK, but we have a public defender system here where if you're charged with a crime, if you can't afford your own lawyer, the state provides you one. And the public defender system is a disaster. You know, there are dedicated, hardworking public defenders. I know some of them. There are also a lot who are not good. They just sort of, that's where you end up if you don't have other options, and they don't get the resources private lawyers need. So that's the kind of thing where it's not sexy to talk about. But of course, in a, you know, still racially unjust society, Black people are much more likely to not have money and get public defenders. And then, you know, they end up in jail, whereas a rich person in the exact same situation would not end up in jail. That is a complicated, nitpicky policy issue that you can't just talk about it by just repeating white supremacy a few times. Cause, you know, I just, since George Floyd was murdered, I just wish more of the discussion was on stuff like that rather than on like how we talk or whether we capitalize Black or microaggression, stuff like that.
It feels like a very simple, this idea that we can just solve everything as long as everyone uses the correct words or, you know, and as you say, Katie, the evidence seems to say that it just doesn't work. It feels like it's creating a society that is more racist, actually. And yet we can see that the progress made since the civil rights movement, we can see that social liberalism as a means to address racism does have tangible effects. And yet we're writing it off. That makes me nervous.
Yes, I think it should make you nervous.
Mm. And I totally accept what you're saying, Jesse, about your history in America is very different from the history here. But if I can just give you an example of the way in which these ideas have been imported to us, we have a major, one of our major supermarkets here is called Sainsbury's. And it's just, I suppose, the equivalent of Walmart or something like that. And they've recently started putting out posts where they are berating people on Twitter about Black history. They're talking about they're going to review their ethnicity pay gap and what a horrible work environment it is for Black people at Sainsbury's. In other words, they're telling me how racist they are. And I don't want to shop at a racist supermarket, to be honest. And this feels like something that's just it's weird. It's come over from a different, from an American culture, an American context. It doesn't make sense to say that a Black employee at Sainsbury's in London is being oppressed by their employer. And also, why is a supermarket telling me how racist they are?
I mean, I find that just as weird when you have these big companies in the States, in many cases, evil big companies posting about how anti-racist they are. It's just like, it's so obviously pandering.
It's performance.
Yeah. And so I don't think our cultural context makes that any less cringeworthy. But you know what? That aspect of it is a fad. And I suspect that it's not going to last because it's exhausting to try to run a supermarket and also be anti-racist. Yeah, I agree. It's just incredibly weird.
This funny thing has happened over here where one of the institutions that has become the most woke is the NFL. You know, an organization that, like, when I think of like American football players, you know, I think of like the football players I went to high school with who mostly like called the gay kids fags and were the ones most likely to be accused of date rape. It's this violent sport that causes brain damage to people. And now, like in Seattle, for instance, there is a conservative talk radio host just got canned by the Seahawks, our local NFL team, for making a joke on Twitter. It was a joke about the governor, but it sort of referenced trans stuff.
Yeah.
And so to see the Seahawks sort of standing up for the trans community is just like, sure, it's great, I guess. It's also funny.
Yeah, of course. And there's a level of hypocrisy as well. Whenever I see a major corporation doing these signals and you think, yeah, but don't you have sort of a sweatshops and don't you have sort of child labor going on? And maybe don't hector other people about their morality. You're not really in the best position to do it.
But people love it. People eat it up. People want to see Nike sort of championing social justice values while still employing child labor or whatever. They want their Doritos to be woke.
I don't think they do. I think the people you see on Twitter do. I think the average American is like,
yes,
maybe exhausted by this stuff by now. Yeah.
Didn't Gillette lose billions of dollars? So, you know, so it's that the difference between Twitter and Gillette, you know, the razor company. And they started putting out these adverts about toxic masculinity and basically how all their customers are evil. It's not a good selling point, is it? I wouldn't have thought.
No, I think you're right. I think it's very popular among the people I spend all day sort of observing on Twitter. You know, which it's like I always say, like Twitter does not represent the populace, but it does influence the conversation because of the people who are on Twitter tend to be people with cultural power, people in the media, people who write for the New York Times, people who work for these ad agencies or whatever. And it's not, I don't think it's actually reflective of the average American. But I think that is also changing. 3 or 4 years ago, I think very few Americans would understand what a non-binary person is. And today, that has certainly, I don't know if the average American would, but I think, you know, it's certainly far more accepted.
My favorite example of this sort of woke posturing is my favorite American football team is the New England Patriots. And their owner, Robert Kraft, is, you know, I think he's basically a Republican. And he gave $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee. And then when this stuff broke, he gave $1 million to social justice causes. So it's like, whatever, you know, you just got to hedge your bets a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. That reminds me of sort of major corporations donating money to both parties, you know, because whichever wins, they'll do well.
Sure.
Well, what do you make of then when Princeton University, for instance, comes out and says that they are systemically racist, and then the Department of Education investigates them because racism is illegal?
Jesse should take this as a proud Princeton alum.
Well, I went to grad school there. I could not have gotten into the undergrad program. We talked about this on the podcast. One of the mistakes I see some anti-woke people making is gleefully giving investigative powers to the government. Like, Katie and I both agree that there's some sort of funny, trollish aspect to this because, yeah, this letter basically said Princeton was systemically racist. In this woke speak, in which it's like the sense in which everyone is racist, it's the Robin DiAngelo thing of everyone has to acknowledge their racism. It's a little bit different from saying, I committed an individual act of racism. And then the Trump Department of Education responded by sending them a letter threatening to drag the president for testimony. That's bad. You don't want your federal government investigating a private university over a pandering letter. So I understood like the trollish aspect of it. And I think this whole sort of like publicly acknowledge how racist you are thing is sort of silly unless you have specific examples. And it could get you in legal trouble in terms of private lawsuits, because the next time like a person of color has a bad time at Princeton, why wouldn't they say like you admitted yourself you're a racist institution? But I'm against the sort of turning this into something the government investigates.
There's something funny about it, though. I mean, I did laugh at it. But the other thing is, I also think that the charge of racism I consider extremely serious, in the way that I think people should only call other people racist if they do have incontrovertible evidence of it, not just a hunch. I also think you shouldn't admit to racism if you don't mean it. I think there's something bad about that.
But we're in a weird time where you get more points for saying I'm right, because it's part of the ritual is to say you're racist.
The term itself has become, it's like the term Nazi or whatever. Like at the same time that it is more in use than ever, it's also become more meaningless, and yet it is still more charged.
Yeah.
It's very strange. You know, Jesse and I sort of get into trouble with some of our listeners about this because we have I'd say a decent chunk of our audience listens to us because they're sort of anti-woke and they want confirmation that they're correct in their anti-woke beliefs. In some ways, I think that anti-woke beliefs are correct. I agree with some of that sort of thinking. That said, like with, you know, Donald Trump has gone on this witch hunt against critical race theory in the federal government. Both of us are opposed to critical race theory. We're also both opposed to Donald Trump determining what can be, you know, what sort of trainings can be used in these different departments, or just fearful of he'll come out and say something. He'll call critical race theory un-American, and talk about, you know, finding it where you can and reporting it. Well, that's as disturbing as critical race theory. So it's sort of hard to strike that balance where you're opposed to the thing, but you're also opposed to the government overreach. In response to the thing.
I get this all the time, is that sometimes the people I don't like are saying things that I approve of, and that puts me in a very difficult position. I mean, in a sense, wouldn't it be great if, for instance, Biden made a speech denouncing critical race theory? Maybe, you know, shouldn't the liberals be doing that? Because it's an illiberal system. It's an illiberal idea.
I mean, the big problem is that every time Donald Trump does something, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So when Donald Trump says we're going to ban critical race theory from the federal government, what he's actually doing is ensuring that when Joe Biden is, fingers crossed, president, critical race theory will be ushered into the federal government. I mean, I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but you know, there's such a backlash with anything that Trump says that he can automatically make critical race theory beloved in the United States among certain populations.
Well, I think that's true, that the Democrats have become more and more woke as a reaction to Donald Trump. But Donald Trump in of himself, I'm pretty convinced, was only elected in the first place as a reaction against the escalation of wokeness.
It's complicated in the Democratic Party because the least woke competitive candidate won, Biden, by far.
Sleepy Joe Biden.
Sleepy Joe Biden won, and then Kamala Harris will sometimes pretend to use woke speak to pander, but she was a former prosecutor. So there's a bit of a rift among liberals in the U.S. where, you know, Biden won mostly on the backs of black voters in the South who are not woke. Mm-hmm. They want to turn this into like a racial thing. The most woke people by far are white progressives from elite colleges.
And they did not vote for Joe, or they did not prefer Joe Biden.
They did right? not. They were in tears Elizabeth Warren didn't win.
Yeah. But there is a perception, though, that Biden and his team are more and more adopting the language of wokeness. They do talk about systemic, structural, institutional. They do And whether maybe this is, as you say, just gestures.
I mean, he has yet to announce his pronouns. When he starts announcing his pronouns, we might be in trouble. I mean, I am actually concerned. I will be voting for Joe Biden happily, but I am concerned that Joe Biden, they're going to stick him in the corner and, you know, hire Elizabeth Warren's, you know, advisors who will end up ushering this sort of ideology. I'm concerned about that. I am not as concerned about that as I am Donald Trump winning the election. Right. I think that is in part because of this woke ideology. Because Donald Trump winning is, if you do not want wokeness to spread, Donald Trump is the worst case scenario, because the backlash to Donald Trump will just increase the division. It will increase the acceptance of this and spread of this ideology.
So taking an anti-Trump stance, but also having a popular anti-woke audience, and do you find yourself alienating people who are actually on your side?
Oh, we alienate everybody.
Oh, right. Okay. That's part of the appeal, right?
I mean, we get a fair number of emails from people who say I think on balance, our audience is like probably 70 or 80% anti-Trump. But we get emails, including one today, from people who are conservative and say they disagree with us, but they appreciate our ability to just talk things through. And I think at a time when so much media is so hysterical and feels just like an attempt to witch hunt for the baddies and burn them. I just think people appreciate two people like trying to work through these issues in a reasonable way without a lot of vitriol or judgment.
I agree. But I have to say, I mean, my background's from the left, and I have to say that now I find more sympathetic hearing from people on the right, insofar as because I'm talking about these issues, because I'm talking about freedom of speech, yes, due process, liberal values that I've always stood for. I find there's more of an intolerance, as in left people would rather not engage at all and just call people Nazis. I'm getting more sympathy from the right.
Well, yeah, I think that's true, especially on like the idea of people who disagree with you being willing to engage. But there's been this backlash where, like, if you look at the top writers on Substack, you know, the blockbuster new newsletter platform that I'm on, as is seemingly half the journalists in the States, all the big popular new ones are from sort of left or liberal, but not woke people. Like Yasha Monk started a new thing called Persuasion that I think is in the top 10. Andrew Sullivan, whatever you want to put his politics at, he's ardently anti-Trump. He's one of the most popular. Matt Taibbi is very, very yeah, left and very anti-woke. So I think the sort of voxosphere media circle in the US like doesn't really allow these opinions in and increasingly tries to expurgate people who express them, including New York Mag and Andrew Sullivan. But you know, at a certain point, the market decides who's popular and who makes money. And there's clearly a very big appetite for this kind of thing.
So Andrew Sullivan just lost his column, didn't he? Is that right?
Yes.
And to set up his own. That's the great thing about the internet. You can do it yourself now.
He's instantly making several times what he made at New York Magazine.
Right.
Yes. And he doesn't have to, you know, deal with the institutional bullshit that he had to deal with at New York Magazine. He has one editor and he's making so much money, so much money.
So at what point will the American media come to the conclusion that actually it's better to have a diversity of opinion and to hear different views, because otherwise you just end up like the New York Times, which is now considered a joke, I think.
It's interesting because you would think that media would really follow the market. And clearly there is a market for the sort of things that Jesse and I are doing and what these Substack writers are doing. And yet that hasn't really happened. What I've observed is a contracting of values and, you know, what's acceptable to say in the pages of your paper, you know, which has been, I think, terrible for these institutions, but it has been good for individual creators like ourselves.
I think if you like plopped $5 million on the table of someone who runs many of these media companies and you said, here, you can take this money, but the 25-year-olds in your organization are going to revolt and they're going to start petitions and there's going to be drama in the Slack channels.
Yes.
They just won't take the money because they don't want to deal with that shit. And I think that's not the right way to run media businesses, but that's where we are now. I mean, look at what's happened at the Times internally. It's crazy.
Yeah. It is really interesting that these oftentimes lower level staffers really do have power within these institutions. Spotify paid Joe Rogan something like $120 million to use their platform. Then these staffers are trying to stage a coup and get editorial control over Joe Rogan's podcast. It would be a terrible business move for Spotify to listen to them. And I don't think that they will, because it would make Joe's audience revolt in the first place. And he probably has some sort of clause in his contract preventing that, I would assume.
It's the Rogan and like JK Rowling superstar level. That's where it's like, that's where it's so much money that it really is just capitalism. There was a drama at Rowling's publisher too, but they were just like, fuck off. But they won't say fuck off if the person being hounded is like a 35-year-old mid-level writer. I mean, people lose their jobs over this, and it's not a good time to be at most mainstream American publications.
Well, there was a children's author here called Gillian Johnson, I think, who lost her publisher and her agent because she simply tweeted in support of J.K. Rowling.
Yeah,
and that's because
horrible.
She's at a mid-range, you know, she's successful.
Yes.
But she hasn't got the kind of fuck you money that J.K. Rowling has. And no one's going to ditch J.K. Rowling. No one in their right mind.
Right. This is, you know, Jesse and I were both signatories of the Harper's Letter, which was this open letter published in Harper's Magazine that was in defense of free speech. And a lot of the criticisms of the Harper's Letter were that, you know, it was highly successful people like J.K. Rowling and Jesse Singel and Katie Herzog. The little known Margaret Atwood and Noam Chomsky and Malcolm Gladwell. And a lot of the pushback was like, you know, these are all rich people who can't be canceled. What are you talking about? Well, the reality is the letter wasn't about Jesse and I, and it wasn't about Margaret Atwood, and it wasn't about J.K. Rowling. It was about the people who write us every day saying, I'm an academic. I'm terrified of stating my opinion because I'm up for tenure next year, and I know I won't get it if I say that I support J.K. Rowling or whatever the situation is.
That is odd that the people who are denying that cancel culture is a thing, they're always pointing to the millionaires who would never be able to be canceled anyway. Whereas, of course, cancel culture affects normal people. That's what it does.
Yeah,
I would
argue.
So in terms of that letter, yes, that's right. I did see that. A lot of people saying everyone on that list is a millionaire. This is an audio podcast, so the listeners can't see that you're both swimming in money like Scrooge McDuck at the moment. I can see that.
Exactly.
But it is, I mean, there's an assumption though, isn't there, that you've been very successful. You certainly have been successful though, to be fair. I mean, the podcast has done very well. Your Patreon's done very well. I think it is a big, huge success, isn't it?
When we signed the letter, it was not there yet. I mean, just for what
right.
it's worth.
Right. Okay.
Right. I mean, just financially, I mean, I now make twice as much money as I did working as a staff writer at a paper, and I work one day a week. You know, and the only asshole I have to work with is Jesse. So by that standard, yes, it has been a huge success.
And if the culture war ends though, that's not going to be so good. So hopefully it will keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we should vote for Trump, Jesse, just to keep
spark
keep
the
culture
civil
war
going.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here from Spiked. I produce Culture Wars along with all of Spiked's other podcasts. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I know it's early days, but if you think this might be a show that's worth supporting, then the best way to do that is to make a donation to Spiked. Even something as little as £5 per month is hugely appreciated and can make an enormous difference to our work. Your donations help us to keep going and growing so we can keep providing you with new, exciting and ambitious content. If you'd like to make a donation, it's really easy. All you need to do is go to spiked-online.com and hit the donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and hit the donate button. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
Can I ask you, there's something I wanted to ask because it's a story that's just come up and I'm really fascinated by it. I've always been quite interested in the way that the social media tech giants are in lockstep over these issues. And Twitter have now quite rigorously censored this article in the New York Post about Hunter Biden. I don't know if you've seen this. It's anyone even posting the link to the New York Post, and that includes the New York Post editor himself, are having their accounts locked out. The press secretary was locked out for sharing the article. Now, I think there is a legitimate question to be had about, was the information sourced ethically? All the journalistic debates that we often have when tabloids do this kind of thing. What's it got to do with Twitter?
Look, I don't know the details of the story. B, the details I've heard suggest it was really bad reporting and is sort of a last-ditch effort to spark a new or exacerbate anti-Biden conspiracy theories. What disturbed me was just sort of like the instant decision to censor it rather than append it with like a fact-checking notice. As we've said on the podcast, I don't think there are any easy answers to this, to where the line should be drawn, but to instantly take something published in a mainstream American paper and not even allow people to post it. Maybe I wasn't following closely. I thought it wasn't that people had been locked out. It was more they tried to post it and Twitter literally wouldn't let them post it. But either way, that's not good.
They wouldn't let them post it. And there was some actual locking out going on. I mean, I suppose my point in relation to that is I don't trust Twitter to be fact checkers, frankly.
Right. Right. No, I don't either.
The great irony here is that Twitter and Facebook did something. I don't know what they did, but they did something similar. Maybe you didn't get locked out, but they had some sort of notification if you tried to post this and deboosted it from their algorithm or whatever. You know, the real irony here is that this story probably would have died within the 24-hour news cycle had they not taken this measure.
Yes.
So, like, have they never heard of the Streisand effect? I mean, It's just incredibly stupid. And, you know, and I don't entirely blame Twitter for this, because journalists, people in our, you know, in our own field have been demanding that Twitter and Facebook censor. They've been demanding this sort of thing. And then so when it happens and they botch it, they totally botch it. Well, surprise, surprise. Who really should we blame here? I mean, these platforms do not want to be publishers. They want to be platforms. And we have put them in a position of requiring them to become, to moderate the, you know, the content that we see.
I accept that they are under a lot of pressure to be seen to be doing something. But on the other hand, whenever they are sued for anything that appears on their platform, they do say, yes, but we're not a publisher. And yet they do right. choose to censor certain things. It does feel inconsistent and incoherent to me.
Now, I think it is.
Either just let everyone say what they want. And that's what the block button's for, isn't it?
The Republicans right now in Congress are attempting to regulate them because they see anti-conservative bias in these platforms. Well, I don't think that's the answer either. As much as I don't trust Twitter to regulate what we can see, I don't trust the government either.
So what is the answer? Because I'm torn on this as well, because I understand the principle that, you know, they're a company, they should be able to do whatever they want. But right. social media is the monopoly. These companies right. do have the monopoly. So it is the de facto public square, is it not? So what right. do we do about that?
I mean, if I were Jack Dorsey, or Mark Zuckerberg, what I would say, you know, and I were immune to pressure, if I had fucky money, what I would probably say is we are going to abide by the First Amendment. And, you know, the only content we will moderate is illegal content, is defamation, is threats of violence. And I would be much more of a free speech absolutist about it. And, you know, you can do things like fact checking, although who's fact checking the fact checkers is a question. You know, they employed Snopes to do some fact checking on Facebook. Well, Snopes also has a pretty clear bias.
Yes.
You know, so it is immensely complicated and there are no real good answers here in some way.
But also, what do you do when the ideology that seems to have the cultural control don't really believe in facts or objective truth?
I mean, I think you could say that about if Republicans had control or if conservatives had cultural control, I think you could say the same thing.
You could, but even verifiable things such as there is such a thing as biological sex.
Sure.
You know, I don't trust the people who claim that that is not the case to be fact-checking other people.
Sure, but we have a super spreader event inside our own White House because they wouldn't put on masks. So, you know, there's different versions of denying reality. And I'm with Katie right. that, like, ideologues do that in general. But overall, I'm with you. I don't trust Twitter to make these calls at all. I'm totally in favor of Twitter. You know, it's a company. They don't want to host Holocaust denialism or other like really, really gross ideologies. I'm maybe not as much of a free speech purist as Katie on that front when it comes to private companies, but I just think in many cases they've overreached and I think this might be one of them.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what I've been concerned about since they even, you know, from the beginning of banning Alex Jones, this is not going to end with Alex Jones. And we're seeing that in real time.
Have you ever been demonetized or had anything like that happen to you?
No, we haven't been demonetized for the podcast. I was banned from Twitter for 12 hours for making what I thought was a very innocent joke about Mitch McConnell dying. But that's the closest I've gotten to any institution. And that wasn't a like anti-woke statement. It was, I got banned because conservatives mass reported me.
Okay. So just on the naughty step for 12 hours and that's...
I was putting time out.
You learned your lesson. I found that I usually get 7-day bans off Twitter and that they normally come from jokes that mention violence but are not endorsing yes. violence, but I think their algorithms pick up on.
Is this, and do you ever get banned from your own account or is this from?
No, I've never been banned from my own account at all. But then because I'm just not a confrontational person, I don't really say contentious things on my own account. So I'm sort of safe there. But you know,
well, that's what's so brilliant about what you've done is that you have an alter ego who can do it for you.
Yeah, I get that a lot. I get people saying, well, what, you know, you're talking through a woman. You're a misogynist because you're talking through a woman. It's like, yeah, it's a character. Writers create characters that aren't themselves, right?
They used to. That's not allowed anymore.
Well, this is true, you know, as we've seen over the past few days. But who is the actor who's got in trouble for wanting to play Cleopatra?
Gal Gadot.
Yeah.
Cleopatra, who is like Greek or Macedonian, right?
Yeah, but she's Israeli.
Was Arabic.
Right.
But this is what gets me is just the level of ignorance surrounding all of this. Like, there's a difference between ethnically Egyptian and Arab, for one thing. Cleopatra was herself, I think, looked pretty white. If the outrage wasn't dialed up to 11, maybe the ignorance wouldn't bother me so much. But right. on so many of these controversies, it's just like, you can see how the average person is exhausted by this stuff and just flees Twitter immediately.
Sure. Because it's not just outrage. It's like, fuck you, bitch. You should die for taking this. I mean, it's that level of often explicitly misogynistic hatred. I don't get why you'd care that much. Or, you know, how is it we've got to the point where that's someone's initial reaction? Or was it just always the case and we're seeing it more because of social media?
I think people were always, I mean, when you look at just like the history of sort of small town witch burnings or just, we're a petty, gossipy people. And now we have tools that unfortunately are built to, the creators of these tools benefit when they stoke the worst parts of human nature. And this is the all too predictable result.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that the new rule that you must only play your own demographic, I do think that is new. But the outrage itself is not new. The outrage about stupid shit.
I think that role should be played by an actual person of ancient Egyptian royalty. Like they should dig someone up.
Yeah.
Sort of a Weekend at Bernie's type of thing.
Just prop up the corpse.
Yeah, that's
the only fair way to do it.
That would be great. Yeah. Why not?
I assume that this case is also more heated because she is Israeli.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen some quite actually explicitly anti-Semitic tweets aimed at her as well on that basis.
Wait, anti-Semitism on Twitter?
It would be interesting if we could, you know, have an alternate scenario where a Palestinian is given this role. I doubt that we would see this outrage. In fact, people might be celebrating it.
I wonder though, I mean, even with the moderate people who are complaining about it, who aren't, you know, sending the death threats, who are, you know, I'm trying to think through the logic here. What exactly is at stake? What could go so horribly wrong if this woman plays this role? I'm trying to be sympathetic here. What could actually, what's the objection? I can't see it.
I mean, nothing. Okay. So Scarlett Johansson a few years ago, she was going to play a trans guy in some movie. And there was a crazy, crazy outcry. And as far as I know, the movie is now not being made. I think it was called Rub and Tug. And they had, you know, they had a star. When you have a star attached to the project gets greenlit. Well, when the star is ousted from the project and you have to hire a trans man, who's it going to be? Who is going to float this project when they lose the star? So, you know, the irony is that this story probably won't get told at all.
I find it odd though, because I've heard for years, and people recently have been saying things like, don't give queer roles to non-queer people. And but like, you know, gay people have been playing straight roles for decades. Rock Hudson, you know, John Travolta is not gay, I should say. He's not gay. It's definitely not gay. But you know the point. It shouldn't matter, should it?
About consistency. It's about power and outrage, and people can raise their own stature by taking part in these pylons and sometimes carve out jobs for themselves. A lot of it is disingenuous.
I wish that was, I could be so sure. Like what makes me nervous is that I think they mean it and that it's not as calculated as that.
You could be right. Yeah.
I tend to think of a lot of this stuff as just, it's a meme, you know, and that's a sort of disappointing answer when people ask you why all of this is happening. My answer is that humans are incredibly faddish species. We are very prone to social contagion across the board, whether it's ideology or it's names or it's dog breeds or it's fashion. We are just driven by what the people around us do. And so the hopeful thing is that memes also fade.
Maybe we should just blow the whole thing up and start over, reset the simulation.
So you're not optimistic.
I think Katie and I have talked about this on the podcast. I think if Joe Biden wins, things calm down. I think I disagree with Katie's idea that this will like usher in more of the most divisive stuff. Cause I think the people running Biden's campaign understand if he wins, they will understand why he won. And he will have won by just being sort of the bland, reasonable guy. And they will want to continue winning and continue exerting power. And many of the Democrats who they're going to have to wrangle to pass legislation are from districts where people are not woke. And in 2018, when the Democrats retook the House, it was not on the backs of like super woke AOC types. It was on the backs of like former CIA analysts, suburban moms. So I do think sometimes in the rush to criticize the most annoying aspects of wokeness, people fail to account for how diverse the sort of Democratic coalition is in the states. And that's what I think will maybe be the saving grace. Also, if Trump is out of office, there will just be less crazy shit to respond to. Trump makes people crazy because he says horrible and scary things.
You are making me rethink this in terms of the wokeness of the Democratic Party, insofar as they never do well, do that at the Squad. And as you say, Kamala Harris, I mean, didn't she was kicked out of the primaries really early, wasn't she? She wasn't at all popular amongst Democrat voters.
Which is sort of the irony of her being named as vice president. She is not someone that people wanted, and she will probably be the first, if Biden wins, she will probably be the first woman president in the US.
And she wasn't particularly flattering about Trump, was she?
Biden.
Biden. Yeah. Cause didn't she say that his accusers were telling the truth? And
yeah, she called him racist.
And she called him, okay.
And so he did the natural thing. Yeah.
It's fine. Yeah. Amazing. I mean,
You know, I'm glad that Biden decided to choose a female vice presidential candidate because I think it was time. However, the way he went about it by announcing that he was going to choose a woman of color, I think it put her in a bad position because now we all know that the reason that she was selected was not because she was necessarily the best candidate. It was because of her genitals and her skin tone.
Is there any scenario, though, where a Biden victory could actually escalate the culture war?
If Trump, like, refuses to leave office, or he doesn't refuse to leave office, but his supporters, like, take to the streets, I suppose that could make things worse. I'm not that concerned about that. I mean, after Trump won, what many of us on the left did was declare his presidency illegitimate, which, because he lost the popular vote, it felt very illegitimate, and take to the streets and start marching. That didn't lead to civil war. You know, so I think that the same thing might happen on the right. Like, they're more likely to maybe have guns or something like that than on the left. But I'm not all that concerned about, like, Trump caravans terrorizing cities. Like, I've never seen something that you see. Even where I live in Washington State, which is maybe the most liberal state in the country, is you'll see these caravans with like 30 trucks. It's almost always a white pickup truck with these giant Trump flags. You don't see that with Biden. You don't see, like, you know, you could get a giant Biden flag and it's just gonna hold down the Prius. You know, people just, like, don't sort of have that passion for Biden. You know, that's a little bit terrifying, but I still think that those are, like, you're seeing small numbers of extremists who were, it's like Twitter. It's just the most visible people happen to be the most extreme.
I just think Americans are completely exhausted. Like, this has been 4 of the most stressful years in our recent history. I mean, nothing during the Obama years was anything like this. So I just, that's what gives me hope, is that if Biden wins, people will desperately want to just lie on the couch for a few months. So I anticipate things would calm down, but who the hell knows at this point?
And just to quickly play devil's advocate, because a lot of the people I've spoken to who want Trump to win, but don't necessarily like Trump, is that they see him as the kind of final bastion against the ultimate push of the social justice movement, and that actually it is more prominent in the Democrats than we think. Is that just completely wrong?
I mean, I think it's wrong because of the backlash, because Trump, he has the government, but the culture is not on his side. The gatekeepers of the cultural institutions are not Trump people. They are mostly on the left. And if Trump wins, all they're going to do is it will confirm to these people that the United States is intractably racist, intractably sexist, bigoted, and that's just going to cause more of the strife. So I think that the worst thing that you can do if you're someone who's concerned about this ideology is support that man.
So you don't anticipate a future where the people who are calling for the First Amendment to be changed so that we have hate speech regulation, for instance, in America, you don't anticipate a future?
No, I see that future. I mean, the New York Times published a piece, I think yesterday, by Emily Bazelon about how the United States should have speech laws more in line with Europe and Canada's. I'm concerned about it. You know, this was in the New York Times arguing for less freedom of speech.
Right. But those are unpopular views, and I'm not worried about it. I think I reject the premise that we should reduce this whole thing to wokeness. And I don't buy the idea of Trump as like a last bastion of it, in part because the US government is this massive, complicated entity that the entire world, for better or worse, relies on. And it's so bad that someone like Trump ever got into that position, and just the damage he's done to all these like sub offices, none of us have ever heard of, and where we don't even know what's going on there. I almost just don't care about the culture war stuff as much as I do about having a functioning government again.
So final question, who's going
to
win?
I think right now, if I had to guess, Biden looks poised to win by a considerable margin, but of course, you can't take anything for granted. It's just the polling is different from 2016. It's a bigger lead for Biden and more consistent. But I think Katie's more pessimistic than I am, right, Katie?
Yeah, I am more pessimistic. I think that Donald Trump has a chance to once again win the Electoral College and lose the popular vote. I am more optimistic than I was this summer when we are seeing more rioting and looting across American cities. I thought that was very, very bad for the Democrats. Trump getting COVID, however, bad for Trump. The fact that he has seemingly recovered from COVID, great for Trump, very disappointing to me. But I think that Trump has lost momentum, and I'm really, really happy to see that. But we live in a system where my vote doesn't matter. Jesse's vote doesn't matter. It's really going to come down to about 6 states. And I don't live in those states. I don't know what's going to happen in, you know, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and North Carolina and Florida, which are really unfortunately the only places that matter in our electoral politics. Great system we've got here. Really good.
Yeah, seriously.
I've given up predicting now. I just won't do it because I always get it wrong. I was convinced Trump wouldn't win. I was convinced that Brexit wouldn't happen. I was actually pleased that Brexit happened, but didn't predict it. Got it wrong. So there we go. Anyway, look, thank you both so much. I really, really appreciate it. Can you tell us where we can find you online? What's the best way to to find your podcast, that kind of thing?
Yeah, if you just go to, hold on, I should know my own. barpodcast.fireside.fm or patreon.com/blockedandreported. I guess if we're doing plugs, I also have a book coming out next year called The Quick Fix. So just Google that on Amazon. Everyone should pre-order that, of course.
Of course. What's it about?
The Quick Fix is about sort of TED Talk style psychological science in the States and why it's so often wrong and why we fall for these sort of cute interventions to fix racism or fix PTSD or education. It's just psychologists in the States have had a very bad decade. So it's sort of an accounting of that.
Great. Do you have a book, Katie, coming out?
Oh, God, no. I the only thing that I write is tweets these days.
You know, if you want to be a grifter, you've got to get a book.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. No, I'm on Twitter at Katie Persaug. You can find the podcast on all major platforms if you search for it. But of course, the most important one is Patreon.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to Culture Wars with me, Andrew Doyle, a podcast for Spiked. If you've enjoyed it, make sure that you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And if you want to hear what I've got to say about some other things, then you could check out my articles at www.spiked-online.com. Please join us again. We're going to have some fantastic guests coming up. I am still trying to get hold of Robin DiAngelo, who wrote that masterpiece White Fragility, but for some reason she's not returning my calls. I don't know what the hell is her problem, frankly. So if I do get her on, there's going to be a row. So there's all that to look forward to. Anyway, see you next time.